accession number 19865, Reel 1.
Colonel Robbins, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Well, I was born in Mansfield in Nottinghamshire in 1929, 23rd of July, so I'm not a Yorkshireman.
Did you grow up and have your schooling at Mansfield?
No, at a very young age. In fact, before I was five, we moved back to my mother's hometown in Derbyshire, a place called Buxton. And I eventually, at 17 and a half, joined the Dukes, a Yorkshire regiment, primarily because it had been my father's regiment, and I, as a child, had been brought up on stories of the Dukes and happenings in various parts of the world. I enlisted at 17 and a half, having been an army cadet since 1943. I had to have my father's signature forged, actually, on the enlistment documents, because he wouldn't agree, and he was most put out to find when I said I am actually joining the army tomorrow. It was only when he said, "What regiment are you joining?" And I said, "I'm joining the Duke of Wellington's regiment," which came as a complete surprise to him. And he then said, "You better make a good job of it." So I tried to do that.
What was his objection?
He felt that I should wait until I was called up, and he didn't see me as a regular soldier, but I wanted to be a regular soldier, and I wanted to get on with it.
Just going back before that to the Second World War, do you have any Second World War memories?
No, nothing of great significance, although obviously the war did affect us. I mean, I left school at 14 in 1943. Most of the male teachers had been called up and gone away. Our sports fields had been dug up, either to provide air raid shelters or to grow vegetables, and so school life was limited. And although I did have the opportunity of what was described as a transfer scholarship to the local college, I turned it down, which with hindsight was probably a mistake. But again, it was all part of my desire to get on with life and not waste it at school.
So in the Second World War, you saw nothing of the bombing of the country?
No, in Derbyshire, we had air raid warnings, and there were a few bombs dropped round about, and one heard and saw occasionally aircraft, but no, nothing of significance at all.
Where did you do your basic training once you joined?
Well, having joined, I was sent up to Scotland to a place called Elgin, which was on the Murray Firth, which was the 30th Young Soldiers Training Battalion. And so I did my basic training there. And although our depot, the Duke's depot, was in Halifax, I didn't go to Halifax at all. I went up there.
What was the basic training like?
Oh, fairly intensive. I went up there in the very bad winter. January 47 was an extremely bad winter in England. Certainly in Derbyshire, there was piles and piles of snow all over the place, and had been for weeks. In Scotland, on the Murray Firth, there was very little snow. And so it was arduous, but enjoyable. I had no problems with the basic training, thoroughly enjoyed it, and was made a recruit Lance Corporal halfway through. And at the end of that period of training, in July 47, I went down to Catrick, where it was the Yorkshire and Northumberland Brigade Corps Training Centre, and it was also the drafting centre for all the, I think it's six regiments of the Yorkshire and Northumberland Brigade at that time. And I, with one or two others, were kept back at Catrick as potential instructors, and did a CADA, and was subsequently promoted. I kept there as an instructor and subsequently promoted to corporal. The 1st Battalion Dukes and the 2nd Battalion the Dukes, who had both been abroad through the greater part of the war, had both come home in 47, And the 1st Battalion was to take over the training role for the rest of the brigade. And I was then posted down to the 1st Battalion in early 48 as a corporal, again, to be used as an instructor to train recruits coming in through Strensel. After about a year there, I was selected to go down to Sandhurst as a sergeant, or at least selected to do a course, an entrance course as an instructor at Sandhurst on the drill and weapons wing. I was only 20 at that time and was by far the youngest candidate on the course, many of them with two rows of medals, and I didn't believe I had much chance of success there. But at the completion of the course, I was one of only two who stayed at Sandhurst at that point in 1949. Although others who were on the course subsequently came back later. So I did 2 years at Sandhurst from 49 to 51 as a sergeant on the drill and weapons wing, which actually gave me a terrific foundation. I saw much more of the rest of the army and had a very wide view of the army as a whole. And I look upon that 2 years as being a very important period in the formation of my army career.
What kind of things did you learn in those 2 years?
Well, one saw standards at Sandhurst, which were higher than anything that I'd seen elsewhere. And one saw met people from many other different regiments and corps. And one was then able to form a much bigger picture of the army and the ability of individuals and the standards that one could aim at. In 51, I rejoined the 1st Battalion, who by that time had been reformed as an infantry battalion. And the system of having a battalion carrying out the training had been abandoned, which was quite proper. It was a total waste of a battalion to have one totally committed to training. And so they formed a proper training depot and activated the battalion. Unfortunately, the 1st Battalion had lost many, many of its senior ranks because many of them either didn't want to instruct or couldn't instruct or saw overseas service as being far more attractive. And so many of the original Duke's senior ranks and junior ranks, junior NCOs, had left the battalion. And when the battalion was reformed, they took many of the instructors or NCOs from the other regiments that had been posted in. So we were very much a hodgepodge reformed battalion in that period, 51. And this was leading up to the time when we were earmarked to go to Korea. The soldiers in my company, when I went back to the battalion, and within my platoon, I was a platoon sergeant in B Company, were either upgraded Royal Pioneer Corps soldiers who were upgraded and posted to the infantry, or downgraded Royal Signal soldiers who hadn't made it at their trade training and were sent to the infantry. And so it was a pretty hodgepodge. We at that time were in 61st Lorried Infantry Brigade, a grand title for meaning that you travel to war in the back of a three-tonner. And we were part of 6th Armoured Division. And BOR was being reinforced at that time. And 6th Armoured Division moved to BOR at the end of 1951, we'd only been there a few weeks when we were warned for Korea. And that struck me as rather a strange bit of planning to move a battalion to Germany and then within weeks of them getting there, warn them for Korea. And instantly the battalion had to start looking at its organisation to prepare for Korea. Bearing in mind that national servicemen, many were not eligible to go. And many of the other soldiers that we had, for example, some had come from the Green Howards, having done a tour in Malaya, were what were known as Python protected, inasmuch that they'd done a 3 years overseas tour And under the terms at that time, having done 3 years overseas, it was agreed that they wouldn't be sent overseas again until they had so much time back in UK or BOR, which counted as UK service. And by this time, I was acting company sergeant major of B Company while the sergeant major was away on other things. And one of the first jobs I had was going through the company roll to try and sort out who was going to be eligible to go to Korea, whether they had long enough to do or whether they had any medical problems or whether they had any other overseas service like the Python Protection Scheme, which debarred them. And very few of the soldiers of the battalion were eligible. And it was obvious that we were going to need considerable reinforcements to bring us back up to strength to be fit to go to Korea. However, another problem then raised its head from my point of view, because I was sent for to be seen by the commanding officer, who said that I was to be retrained as the battalion signal sergeant, which came as a complete shock to me, because although I was quite eager to do some specialist training, I would have much preferred mortars or anti-tank or machine guns, as I told him. But he told me quite in no uncertain terms that I was to be retrained and was going to be the signal sergeant for Korea. Colonel Bunbury was the commanding officer at the time. He was a very experienced man. I'd commanded a battalion in action in Italy during the war and got a DSO. And I'll say at this stage that though I wasn't delighted to be told I was going to be the signal sergeant, the battalion were fortunate in having a commanding officer like Ramsay Bunbury to lead us and guide us at that point.
Why did you prefer mortars or anti-tank weapons?
Well, because it was a little bit more warlike, and I thought I would be better suited to that type of weapons. I'd been a weapons instructor, small arms instructor, I'd been a drill instructor, and that those particular skills didn't seem to me to be particularly helpful for someone about to get involved with radio and communications and voice procedure. However, I had to get on with it and had to buckle down. One of the greatest problems was that I had to learn Morse, the Morse code, because one of the requirements of the signals course is that you had to pass in to be able to send and receive Morse code at up to 8 words per minute. 8 words is not particularly fast, but on the other hand, it was one hell of an effort to learn the Morse code, particularly to receive Morse at 8 words a minute and be able to get it down logically. And that was the major stumbling block to most people going on signals courses at that time, even those that had had a long time to prepare, and I only had some weeks because I was going off early in, February time to pass in on the signals course. And if I didn't pass in at Morse, then I didn't pass in at all. It's enough to say at this time that I never, ever, after completing the signals course, ever used Morse, but it appeared to be one of the requirements. The signal platoon at that time, as an indication of the state of preparedness of the battalion, there was hardly anyone in the signal platoon other than the signals officer, a chap called John Reddington, and two young lance corporals who were also being buffed up to go on the signals course in the whole platoon who were eligible. The platoon was under strength, and the ones that were there in Germany were either Python protected or didn't have long enough to do. So it's quite clear that signal platoon had to be reformed totally from scratch. Another chap who was selected to go on the course at the same time was Nick Norton, who was a second lieutenant who had been in my company at Sandhurst as a cadet. And although he was a Russian linguist, he hadn't done signals either. So Nick Norton and myself and one of the two lance corporals had places on the signals course, which we did. There was a 3-month course, which we did successfully. and I rejoined the battalion at Pontefract. Or at least the battalion had come back to Pontefract and gone on leave, and I rejoined them, believing that I was going to join the advance party for Korea, which is what I'd been warned on before I went off. Strangely, I found that I wasn't a member of the advance party in rather an unusual way, in as much that I was in my hometown in Derbyshire, in a fairly small, remote pub, having a drink with my father one evening, when a Duke of Wellington's officer, a major, unknown to me, walked in and sat down and ordered a beer. And I walked across to him and introduced myself and said that I thought I ought to introduce myself. And he, to be told that he was the second in command of the battalion at that time. And he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm just on leave. I'm going to rejoin the battalion in Pontefract and go on the advance party." And he said, "But you're not on the advance party." And I said, "But I am. I've been told I am." He said, "I've got the list for the advance party and you're not." I said, "Oh, well, fine." He said, "Anyway, the commanding officer will be in a couple of minutes. He's just parking the car." And shortly afterwards, in walked Ramsay Bunbury, who said, "Robbins, what are you doing here?" So again, I told him, and he said, "Oh, get your body back there. The advance party has been changed." But that was very strange, that in this remote pub in Derbyshire, they were on some cross-country run from Pontefract to somewhere else and had just called in for a drink. However, I went back to Pontefract thinking, well, it gives me chance now to reorganise the Singh platoon, to be gripped by the officer IC rear party and said, "We have a draft of 120 who are going on field firing, and you are going to be my chief instructor on the field firing." I said, no, "I am the signal sergeant." No, "You're not," he said. "You are going to do field firing with me." So for the next 3 weeks, I organised field firing, and the signal platoon did nothing, virtually. We eventually got the battalion back together. The advance party went off with the signal subaltern, Nick Norton, going on the advance party rather than me. And we got the battalion together to get on the boat, the Devonshire, from Liverpool in September. The battalion was totally new to me by that time. I'd seen and met very few of them because we'd had drafts in from all the other regiments of the Yorkshire Brigade, and of course drafts in from the training depot, and any signallers that had come in from other regiments was sent to the signal platoon, and we were then training signallers on the boat on the way to Korea. We were doing voice procedure, which was fine. We were also sort of doing line exercises, laying telephone wires round the boat to practice line, and trying to get the platoon into some sort of shape.
What is voice procedure?
It's the system of speaking on the radio, that you have to use a certain procedure, when to use Roger and when to use Out, and what the various radio appointment titles are. When you refer, say, to the commanding officer, you don't call him the commanding officer. He is Sunray at whatever level. And various systems to make sure that there was discipline on the air and people didn't interrupt each other whilst they were speaking. And that's an important part of using the radio effectively. So we trained on the boat, and we'd got the platoon into some sort of an organisation. It was 6 weeks sailing from Liverpool to Busan, the odd stop off on the way to have a run ashore, which was quite interesting, through the Suez Canal and Singapore and Colombo. On Busan, of course, we then met, as I'm sure you've been told by many others, by an American army band playing jazz on the quayside in polished helmets and white gaiters, which didn't seem like the sort of wary thing that we'd expected. And we eventually got off the boat and onto a train, which was going to take, I don't know how many hours, 15 hours or something, to get from Busan up to where the Commonwealth Division administrative area was. And that was quite an interesting but very slow and uncomfortable journey, but one saw something of the country and the absolute poverty of people that were there. And round Pusan we were all appalled to find people, thousands of people, living in what amounted to cardboard boxes and shacks of all descriptions. We got to the Commonwealth Division area behind the line where we were given our winter clothing and began to shake out into some sort of order. The winter clothing, of course, at that period, we're talking 52, the war had been going on a couple of years by then, the winter clothing was first class. We were extremely fortunate. The early troops in, of course, had not had the proper clothing, particularly the winter clothing. We were more fortunate and we got combat kit and string vests and boots, cold, wet weather, which were heavy and cumbersome but certainly kept your feet dry and warm. And we got parkas and we got sleeping bags. Unheard of luxuries previously, because the British Army hadn't had, in my experience, that type of clothing before. The war, of course, was by this time fairly static. The two sides were very much back, roughly on the 38th parallel. Seoul, we were just north of Seoul, and so Seoul was in the sector controlled by the South, the South Koreans and the British and the Americans and the other United Nations countries. And the line had become very static. We did a workup exercise under the brigade commander before we went in the line. Brigade commander was Brigadier Joe Kendrew, who was a very strong personality. He'd been a Royal Leicestershire Regiment. I think at that point he'd got three DSOs, and he got another DSO in Korea after our battle on the Hook. I'm told he'd never been to Staff College. But with three DSOs and having played rugby for England and Leicester, who needs Staff College? So Joe Kendrew, who we met as a regiment a number of times later, was a very capable soldier, but a very hard soldier as well, and didn't suffer fools gladly at all. And we had a test exercise with him, which was an advance to contact and an attack on a hill, which again was a little bit unrealistic because the war had been static for some time and the war remained static. And of course, I don't think the United Nations had any plans at that point to attack and go further north. They were quite happy to hold where they were and do the peace. But however, it shook the battalion out and we worked out. We took over from the Welsh Regiment. Most of the handover had been done as regards stores and equipment, and they'd been pulled out of the line for us to take over. Just an interesting little coincidence of war. When I was an army cadet, one of the other chaps in the army cadet force in Derbyshire was a chap called Kevin Sutton, and he was there in Korea as the signal sergeant of the Welsh Regiment, and I was literally taking over from him as the signal sergeant of the Dukes. I didn't see much of him, but there were one or two bits of kit, which in later years, when I met him over a beer and said, "Where were those charging engines that you told me were in location and I never found?" But it, as I say, the other side of the world, you met a chap who you'd been to school with and been an army cadet with. But however, we went into a comparatively quiet part of the line, known as Yongdong initially, and that was towards the left of the Commonwealth Division sector, with 355 and a major hill feature on the right. And the major hill feature, or the major feature on the left, was the Hook, which was across a valley from where we were, and the Black Watch were on the Hook at the time. In our brigade we had the Black Watch, the Dukes and the King's Regiment, and the Black Watch were on the Hook. And whilst we were on Yongdong, they had quite a serious battle there. I think it was become known as the First Battle of the Hawk. And we could see all the fireworks going on, and indeed the machine guns from the Dukes were able to fire across the valley, across the front of the Black Watch, and give them some support there. But the position that we were on was quite a long way at that point from the Chinese, and therefore, apart from the rifle companies being involved with patrolling and some incoming shells and mortars, it was comparatively quiet. There wasn't a lot going on. However, it was the opportunity to sort of bed out our communications, and the organisation of the signal platoon was totally unlike anything that had been taught at the signal school. And so not only did I not use the Morse, which I'd so diligently learned, a lot of the other organisation was totally different. We had a vast network of line or telephone communication to maintain in every position that we occupied. There were telephone wires literally all over the place. The Americans or the Canadians or other nations, when they'd occupied, they very rarely tried to repair a line. If it went out, they just laid a new line. So there were masses of cable all over the place. We had been taught, and the British system at the time was to have a single line with what was known as earth return. So that at one end you had a telephone with an earth terminal and then a single line of cable, and at the other end you had another telephone or an exchange with an earth terminal. And in that way you communicated using what was known as an earth return. We didn't use any earth return in Korea. We were on American twin dog, known as Dog 10 cable, which is much, much more efficient. But again, it just added to the jumble of wires. And line communication, or telephone as people would know it, was the major day-to-day form of communication rather than radio. We had radio, and that was tested and netted. Each of the companies in the major locations had what we knew as 62 sets, which was a low-frequency set requiring a wet battery similar to a car battery, which had to be charged, and each battery would only last about 8 hours on full charge, to be charged by charging engines in the field. And of course it was a major problem to keep batteries supplied for 62 sets. They weren't the best set either, because they'd been designed for the infantry as a set that was man-packable, which had affected their power and their range. The artillery and the gunner OPs, for example, and the tanks all had 19 sets, which was a vehicle-borne set, but which they carried out of vehicles and mounted in bunkers. And so they had a much better set. So our 62 sets weren't very effective. We also had what were called 31 sets, which was a high-frequency set, which almost required, because of the method of working of high-frequency, almost required visual aerial-to-aerial contact. If you got behind a hill or down in a bunker or in low ground, you were screened, and those sets wouldn't work very well. So we had to try all sorts of systems to get the aerial up high or get the set up high. We didn't have proper conversion kits, which came in later, to remote the handset or the headsets. And for example, on the Hook position, the battalion headquarters, which was on a reverse slope behind a hill feature, the only way we